So, what I'd like to do this morning is two things. I'd like to talk for a little while, hopefully a little while, on a theme which is interesting for me, and I think can be interesting or should be interesting for you. A theme that I offer to you as a reflection, so you can reflect on it and practice with this and investigate this issue during the week. And I'd like to make my comments relatively short. I don't know how long I can manage. But then, and then turn it over to you to give you a chance to ask questions, certainly on what I've raised as a theme. But also, I've been gone for quite a while, and Tarnia's been here, and maybe it'd be nice for you guys to bring up questions and issues that you might have about your spiritual life, your practice, your Buddhist practice, your mindfulness. And also, it's nice for me to hear what's on, you know, what's going on with you. So it kind of has a double function. We could just do that the whole morning, but I thought maybe it's more useful for me to start a little bit and warn you. This is what's that you guys, you know, can start thinking about what you might want to ask. Seem okay? So, what's on my mind is the theme of desire. And desire, as many of you know, is kind of central to the whole Buddhist spiritual practice, dealing with desire, confronting it, understanding it, becoming free of certain kind of desire. And I was reminded recently of an incident that happened when I was about 20 or 21. And I was hitchhiking through Denmark. And I think it was in the morning because that night before, I was hitchhiking through, and someone had dropped me off in some town in Denmark. It was dark, and very dark, and I didn't know where to go. It was dark. I wasn't going to hitchhike anymore. It was late, and I didn't know. So there was this low stone fence, and looked like in the dark, it kind of looked like maybe a park just beyond it, and it was kind of easy access, and a lot of shrubs and trees and open space, and I thought certainly it was a park. So I climbed over that little stone fence and rolled out my sleeping bag under the bushes and was going to sleep there for the night, and woke up to find that I was sleeping on a cemetery. So the next, that morning, then I got a ride from this young Dane, and I was talking about. He was asking me questions. I was talking. You know, mostly I was talking, and I went on and on about all the things I wanted to do. And, you know, I wanted to practice Zen Buddhism. I wanted to practice Sufism. I wanted to do Aikido. I wanted to study Rolfing. I wanted to study Gestalt. I wanted to live on a farm and do organic gardening. I wanted to, you know, do this. And it went on and on, all these desires. And finally, he turned to me and said, "You have a lot of desires." And, you know, it hadn't occurred to me. And certainly that has, you know, I pay attention to that at the time, and since then I've kind of reviewed that little incident a fair number of times. And you know, this momentum of desire, of wanting things, maybe you can say it's quite natural for someone who's 21 to kind of try to find his or her life and organize it and get it going and to have these desires and pursue it. But there seemed to be no end to the kind of desires that I had. It was like a lot of things that I could want, and there were more desires than a person can reasonably pursue, maybe even in one lifetime. And here I was, you know, thinking that I could, you know, should pursue them all simultaneously. And what I noticed was that certainly it was impractical to have so many desires, but I noticed was the degree to which there was suffering because of those desires. There was kind of a compulsion and a contraction of wanting and needing to get those things. And then kind of the mind kind of searching in a contracted way, you know, how to fulfill those. But what was even more interesting was, aside from that kind of suffering, was over time, it took some time to realize this, to realize that underneath that all those various wonderful, wholesome, good desires that I had, in that conversation with that fellow and telling him what my desires was, there was another desire which was more fundamental, perhaps. And that was, in telling him all these desires, I had a desire to tell him who I was. I was trying to define myself in relationship to him through these wonderful desires that I had. And what? And ain't I a wonderful guy? You know, because this is the kind of things I want to do. Let alone I hadn't done them, you know. But, you know, because this kind of defined who I was. And there was this desire to be defined, to represent myself a certain way so I can be seen by that person in a way that I thought was favorable. I was trying to create a persona, in a sense, so that this person would like me or admire me or something. And it took me a number of years to realize that I was doing that in the conversation. Then I remember that earlier when I was 17, hitchhiking around Europe, maybe 18, some years earlier, that then I had done this intentionally because I thought it was kind of fun, you know, every person who picked me up, I would try on a new persona and a new history, a new biography, to see what that was like. And, you know, just kind of experimenting and finding out this whole issue of identity and who I was and all that. And there wasn't so much at stake when I was maybe 17, 18, but when I was 21, you know, it was like... So there's these desires, you know, desires for certain things that we have, and the desires sometimes underlies that, which is a desire for a certain identity, a certain way of representing ourselves, which can also cause a lot of suffering. In the Buddhist tradition, desiring, is not a moral issue, which some people, when Buddhists talk about desire, they take it as a moral issue, you know. What's wrong with desire? The issue is there suffering connecting to the desire? And is there a possibility of greater happiness in relating to our desires in a different way or ending our desires in a certain way? Another little story of in my 20s when I used to read a lot. And when I was in my teen years, I used to be absorbed in my reading and couldn't hardly get my attention. I was so absorbed in reading. In my 20s, I still read a lot. And I love to go into bookstores. And I just go into bookstores and I just look at all these books that I wanted to read. Right? This desire. And I noticed after some time that I would leave bookstores in a much worse state of mind than I'd entered the bookstore. And after a while, I realized the reason for that was when I went into the bookstores, the desire mode operated big time. I wouldn't buy books, but I'd go in there and just, I want that, I want that, I want that. And that's a great book. I want. And it had this deleterious effect on my mind, on my psyche, on my eyes. And I kind of feel heavy and a little bit tight and sometimes a little bit headachy and sometimes kind of drained from, you know, this place where it was, I could have a desire a second because there were so many titles. And it was quite exhausting. So it is not a moral issue, but rather it's an issue to be reflected on. Look, you know, how does desires work in our lives as practitioners? When desiring gets in the way and is unhealthy for us, doesn't really work for our mental and physical well-being? Because if the desire is insistent enough, it has a physiological effect on us also. I feel it often tightening in different places of my body, tightening around my eyes and my jaws and my shoulder, my chest, my arms, and everywhere. You know, a certain tightening. Sometimes I don't notice the subtlety of that tightening until I sit down to meditate. And I feel kind of a pattern of tightening around my body. And then as I sit, the patterns kind of relax a little bit. And it kind of feels sometimes as if it, kind of the energy is shifting in my body. But I think it's just a subtle patterns of tension that are over the body that are beginning to relax and sort themselves out. So it's not a moral issue, but rather an issue of health, I mean, basically physical, but particularly psychological health. And you know, some people take care of their physical body, you know, the exercise and stuff, more than they take care of their minds. Some people take care of their clothes and how they appear to the world much more carefully than how they take care of their minds. And meditation is one of the places where we practice mental hygiene, where we learn to look very honestly at what goes on in our minds. What are the impulses, the motivations, what are the forces that are going on, and which of them are healthy and which of them are unhealthy? Which of them are helpful for us in our lives and which are unhelpful? And I know when I was younger, it didn't occur to me that the mind was something you looked at. And, you know, the mind was what the mind does, the thoughts and feelings and impulses, they're given. They're just, you know, they're just, you're born with them. They're just natural. They're so inherently who I am, they can't be wrong, can they? And they're very, you know, to be believed and acted on. And you know, and somehow they were so inherent in who I was, that the idea of kind of maybe changing a little bit the mind stream, I thought was inappropriate. It was kind of changing the nature of who I was. What I've learned over time in practice is the mind is an arbitrary phenomena. And I don't identify so strongly anymore with what my mind thinks and feels and is motivated by. It's a stream that can be changed and adjusted depending on all kinds of circumstances, including my recognition of what is helpful in the mind, what is healthy, and what is not. And to shift the intentionality, the stream of intentions and stuff. So when I notice when there's a lot of desire, I let go of it. Coming down here today, there was a subtle desire I noticed. I realized coming down here, I had realized it for some days, that I was supposed to give a Dharma talk this morning. And I think it's fairly natural to, you know, at some point when you get close to doing an event like this, to start reflecting and thinking and what you're going to talk about and what's useful. And I think it's appropriate to have the mind engaged sometimes in that kind of activity. So that was happening walking down here. But then I tried to be somewhat introspective and be mindful of what's going on. And I noticed that my motivation for thinking about what I was going to talk about was mixed. There were a lot of different motivations feeding into my thinking about it. And there was a particular motivation that in walking down here, I noticed was causing me some suffering, some tightness, some contraction. And that was, I had the desire, or the wish, or the wanting, to make a good impression on all of you. And somehow, you know, the same thing as when I was 21. I'm like, you know, wanted to kind of present myself a certain way, and I don't want you guys to, you know, think poorly of me, and who's this guy, and some of you never heard me, and you know, this is the one chance for me to prove myself to you that I'm a, you know, adequate teacher, and so, you know, it's really important what I say, so I better plan it well. Certainly not admit that I have this failing, this fault, in public to all of you. And so I noticed that, and so that's where the suffering was related to, this thinking about it. And luckily, once I recognized it, it was relatively easy just to let go of that piece. The difference from my years of practice is that when this kind of motivation arises, that it's not so tenacious. There's not so much compulsion and drivenness and neediness around this idea of my self-image and what other people think about me. When I was younger, it was really central to what motivated my life, and it was very hard to let go of it. But now it's like this little, you know, it arises still, but it's like a little pesky fly that arises. I just kind of shoo away, or I just, you know, can let go of pretty easily. And that I attribute a lot to the power of my mindfulness practice and the ability certainly to notice it when it first arises. And one of the ways I notice it is to notice where the suffering is, the contraction, the pain, that's part of it. Because the kind of desire in Buddhism we're trying to address and we're trying to resolve is not all desire, but rather it's that kind of desire which brings suffering. And that kind of desire is usually characterized by compulsion, by a sense of drivenness, by obsession. And we're a kind of compulsive nature that, you know, is kind of driving us in a way that we feel the pressure of that desire, we feel the neediness of that desire. We kind of clamp down around that desire. And it can be phenomenally subtle. Not just simply as subtle as, you know, our self-identity and things like that, but even more subtle. And you can see this also very clearly in meditation, is that there can be desire connected to having thoughts. You can sit in meditation and your mind picks up certain thoughts to pursue. And what fuels that pattern of thinking is desire. Is the food of desire, is the energy of desire. We want something, and so the mind starts thinking along those lines. So in the advantage of meditation is you can start seeing the subtlety of that subtle desire that even affects how we think, let alone how we act and how we talk. And then you can begin maybe certainly be mindful of that and find how to be free of that particular stream of thinking and motivation in the mind. So it's not all desire, but rather that desire which is compulsive, that has a driven nature to it. The advantage of doing this investigation and reflection is that we can slowly, maybe quickly, but slowly at least, learn how to let go of or how to become free of that compulsive nature of our desire. And in doing so, discover a capacity to be at peace and at ease, to be happy. It turns out that desire by itself doesn't make us very happy. It can bring a certain kind of pleasure, and that's part of the addictive quality of desire, is that desire, we're often focusing on the object of our desire, and there can be pleasure in fantasizing and wanting it. But if you can turn the attention away from the object of your desire and pay attention to what it's like intimately and immediately to be in the mode of desiring, so don't focus on what you desire, but focus on what it's like to be desiring, chances are you'll find often that it's unpleasant. Even though there's a pleasant component part that the mind selects out to focus on. And so when we start resolving the desires, not living by the desires and pushed by it, you probably find a deeper level of happiness and joy and well-being that could be said to be innate in your heart. It's already there. If you just kind of relax back and just let it be. One of the most subtle forms of desire, or two forms of desire, is called the desire for bhava in Pali and abhava, for existence and non-existence, for things to exist and things to not exist. Not exist means you want things to push things away, things to be destroyed and annihilated. A kind of aversion, desire for getting things away. But very subtly, it can be sometimes simply the desire to exist as a being, as a person, is a kind of desire which can cause suffering. And luckily, the opposite, the desire not to exist as a person, as a being, is also a form of desire that causes suffering. And Buddhist practice is there to resolve both forms of desire. And for different personalities, different types of people, it's very challenging at the root of their being to be challenged by either desire for existence or the desire for non-existence. Some people feel that, well, if I'm not trying to exist, if I'm not that desire to exist and be someone is not there, I'll disappear, I won't be here. And that's terrible. It's like a death. And for some people, you know, getting away offers the only escape from what they think is the suffering of their life. And Buddhist practice, in a very radical way, resolves both desires. And what's the alternative is a radical way of being at peace and ease and happy with ourselves as we are, without needing anything to be any different. Which is a very challenging idea for many of us. And I would suggest that it's as if that's innate in our heart. It isn't something that's foreign to who we are. It isn't something you have to construct and make happen and talk yourself into. That's a good idea. Not to be driven by any compulsive desires at all, but rather it's something that's innate in who we are. And so we're resting in that innate nature. Does that make sense? Enough? So thank you for listening so well. And so now it's your turn. If you have any questions about this or anything else. And part of the function of asking questions, if you remember, was to help me understand what's current and what's going on in our community and the people here. Yes?
I had a friend ask me something sort of along the lines of what you were just finishing up talking about. That if one lets go of a lot of desires and aversions, doesn't that sort of extinguish part of the personality? And I wasn't really sure how to respond, and it seemed sort of what you were touching on a little bit there, and I was hoping you could expound on the difference between letting go of those unhealthy things that were becoming our personality, but not really extinguishing who we are or it.
No. Well, it's very interesting. The first direction my mind went was that maybe a person's kind of attached to their personality. That's the place where desire and the holding is. You know, I'm this particular kind of personality. And it might be directly because they love their own personality or because somehow their society has taught them you're supposed to be a kind of certain personality, and who would I be if I'm not that way? And And personality is a relative, you know, somewhat fluid thing. We're certainly born certain dispositions in certain ways. But to some degree, personality is fluid. If personality is understood to be in part by what our motivation, a stream of motivations that affect us. So a person might need to look at, you know, their fear around who they think they need to be and who they might, you know, the fear of not being that if they find themselves more at peace, you know, not driven by this kind of stuff. It's sometimes said that, and I think I believe this, that as people's practice matures and as there's more freedom in the personality, in the person, that actually they become more, a person becomes more eccentric. They become more themselves. They become more kind of, there's some kind of innate quality. Their personality becomes freer. And rather than a social constructive personality that we have, and you know that we try to negotiate our world with, becomes, you know, falls away, and we become more eccentric. Now, is that good or bad? Is it frightening or not frightening? It means you're more, you know, you're more free to kind of express yourself and be who you are and respond to the world. Am I approximately answering your question? Approximately. I don't feel like I did a very good job, but I partly lost track of the question. That's why. If you want to ask again. Or...
The question posed to me was, and I think you have touched upon it pretty centrally, is if one starts to let go of desires and aversions, is that not sort of tantamount to extinguishing, you know, at least a part, not more, of your personality?
Yeah, well, that's the fear. I mean, that's one of the core fears that people have. And I'm saying yes, it might, part of it might disappear. That part of the personality which is created by desires might disappear. But it's not all desires we're trying to extinguish. It's just that kind of that craveness, the compulsion that makes us suffer around the desires. And so sometimes it takes a lot of practice to learn to trust just being alive without having those compulsions be part of who we are. And you know, I think of spiritual life, especially Buddhist spiritual life, entails to a great degree a cultivation of a phenomenal degree of trust. And the greater the fear a person has, the greater the need for that trust. The greater trust becomes an issue. Yes.
When I was when I was about 12 years old, my father gave me a pamphlet. It was a 4-H pamphlet. And its title was, and I remember this very distinctly, Young Folks, Do Something, Be Somebody. And I was traumatized by this for quite a long time because I thought I was doing okay as I was. And I think society tends to force this kind of a mindset on us that we need to be something more than what we are or than what we perceive ourselves as being. And I think the best thing we can do is try to ignore that as much as possible.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of people who suffer around this issue, especially people who start practicing seriously and looking at their life. The tension they feel between no longer wanting to kind of follow the status quo idea of what society thinks you should be doing, you know, and they don't want to do, they don't feel like that's what they want to do anymore, but they still feel very much under the pressure of those social norms and you know, family and friends are saying, you have to be normal, which, you know, means having a mortgage and... and such things. Yes.
I hate to bring up such a prosaic problem that word compulsion up for me right now, because I'm in the process of trying to get my son to do his summer reading instead of desire on my part to get him to do it. And I think it's the compulsive quality about my wanting to do it that causes me not to want to do it. And I don't know how to free up all the energy.
Yeah, boy. I'm not qualified to answer that. But I'll tell you about a conversation I had this week with Joseph Goldstein. And hopefully it's relevant. We were talking a little bit, he was asking me, we were talking a little bit about what it's like for me to be a parent. And I was saying that it was very that you know it's a whole different thing to be a parent for me than it had been not being a parent, and what's the nature of the relationship between a parent and a child, and you know very simplistically Buddhism very simplistically please hear it that way, but the Buddhism says that you know attachments are cause of suffering, and with a parent child relationship there's often a level of attachment there. So the question is the kind of bond or the tug of the heart that a parent has with a child, is that a form of craving, a clinging, that practice is supposed to resolve and you're not supposed to have it? Or is it an expression of something innate in that relationship that doesn't really doesn't really have desire or clinging as part of it? It just comes with the territory. You can't even the Buddha would have it. You know, Buddha had a son, and maybe he also had that kind of, you know, tug of the heart and kind of way of relating. And, you know, kind of the example that most kind of points at this for me was when my son was about, I think he was about a year and a half or a year and 5 months, and he was walking a lot by then. And I was walking with him in downtown Palo Alto, if some of you remember outside the AMB Zion Church. And I met someone that I knew on the street there, and I was talking with this couple, and my son, you know, was next to me, and I had my back to the street, and next thing I knew, my son was not next to me, and what I did seemingly automatically, almost like a reflex, like if you touch a hot stove, was I spun around to look at the street, because that's where the greatest danger was, and in fact, he was stepping off the curb at that moment, which was 2 feet behind me, so that was okay, But I was struck by what a reflex that was, you know, that connection between him and, you know, the possibility of him being in danger was so automatic, so quick. And, you know, it's almost like preceded any kind of neurotic or compulsive kind of desire just in that relationship. So Joseph said, "This is really interesting," he said. And he said, this is like, you should write a book on this topic. You know, not a book on parenting, because there's a lot of books on that, but you know, really explore the nature of that relationship, the nature of love, the nature of desire, and really kind of tease these things apart, because I can't do that, he said, but tease them apart into the subtlety of it. So I say all this to you because there might be many different levels going on for you. There's the, you know, you're the mother, and there's this desire for the well-being of your child, and which is maybe, you know, you can't get away from. That's, you know, built into the system. And there's then how do you wisely follow through on that? Because there's a lot of unwise ways of following through on that kind of natural maternal parental instinct that gets in the way, as we know, with teenagers and stuff. And then there's a whole other level that can also be related, as I see also myself, is, you know, this old, you know, demon of self-image and self-identity that ties in. And, you know, what, you know, how are the people going to think about me? If my kid shows up at school and he hasn't done his reading, the parents are going to, the other parents, the teachers are going to think that I'm a failure as a parent. And I'm not getting, I'm trying to get my son to read because for his sake. I'm trying to get son to read for my sake because I don't want to show up at the beginning of the year and get an F in parenting. So there's all these. So the important thing, what I would do in this kind of situation is begin investigating all the different layers, and seeing what are the layers of motivation that I bring that are extra, not needed, that cause me suffering. Because if you're suffering around this, that might be one of the things that a child tunes into. If you're not suffering around it, if the child doesn't feel the compulsive and your neediness around it, because it has to do with your own unresolved areas, I think the child tunes in a very different way. So that's easy for me to say. And, you know, how old is your son now? He's 16. So you know, you can ask me again in 12 years. Or I'll come and talk to you. And the opposite, I'll come and ask you in 12 years for advice. How did you do it? Someone else have ideas? That's a great question. Anybody else? Some of you have gone through this. I should have just turned it over to you before. Yes, please.
Well, that sounds very familiar. When my son was 13 to 15, I was convinced I'd be visiting him in jail or some sort of locked facility. We went away on a trip together for a month during his 16th year. And during that time, I read the book, I think it's called Iron John, about how a young man has to steal the key from under his mother's pillow, the giant. And what I realized is that I was resistant to letting him do that because of all the things that you said I wanted. I was very invested in being a good mother. And so we went away on this trip together, and I didn't know what it was going to be like, because of course the day before we left, he cut his hair in a mohawk and dyed the centerpiece orange. I just thought, you know, this is just what I want to do. Go to Europe and go to Africa with this hair. And so anyway, we went on this trip, and I just about sent him home in London, and then we sort of had it out, and I felt that he was expressing this. He was saying to me, I very much need to find out who I am. And so he really grew up in that month, but I really grew up too. And from then on, it was very painful to say, I am taking the hands off. If you end up not going to college or not doing your reading or not, you know, passing your SATs, that's really your problem. And he came home, and his junior and senior year, he just took care of his life.
Yes.
I'd offer something similar for my own son to grow now, but on the one hand, you answered the question. You said he's not doing his summer reading, and it's his. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, the message you're delivering. But the other part is, and I think this touches on what you were saying, it's perfectly okay with your kids to say, you know, I have a lot of anxiety around this, and these are my expectations. And whenever he doesn't meet the expectations, say, you know, if you haven't met the expectations, I have a lot of anxiety about this. It's up to you to do it. But to let him know that to have the expectations without expecting him to live up to them, really, but with knowing that he may not live up to them and being able to accept that. But making expectations clear, you can let go and yet still make it clear where you're coming from and why you think it's an important value and why you hope that he'll meet your expectations, but let it be okay when he doesn't. Somehow, I think that's possible too. It's not like you have to be dishonest and say, I don't care about your summer meeting. You do.
I think that there's a nature of that problem with the idea of expectations. By the nature of having an expectation, you already introduce the idea of desire. I mean,
well, that's yours to deal with, though. You're letting him know you have that issue.
Yeah.
You're letting him know you have that issue. And it's okay for him to know that it's an issue for you, and then decide whether he wants to make it an issue for him. It's an idea, anyhow.
Comment about parenting, and then I have a question for you. My daughters now are 38 and 40, and I'm a parent, but I have none of this anxiety about anything. It's really nice. I sort of identify more of this instinctual part inside of me to protect them, to get them to this age where They can make decisions for themselves and protect them in many, many ways, psychologically and also physically. And also, I think at times I would recognize when I would, and I would suffer over this, I would have a lot of pain and suffering when I was projecting my stuff through them, what I wanted them to be or what I didn't want to be. And if I could recognize that and let go of it, it was a lot easier for them and for me. Okay, my question has to do in the practice of mindfulness and awareness and insight. I think I'm making a mistake, or I think I'm getting confused. I recognize something, and if it's sort of a judgment or something, that's fine. I can look at it and see where it's at and everything. But then I will look at something else, maybe fear, maybe desire, and I start looking at it deeply in more of an analytical way. And that's the question I have. When is it mindful? When are you bringing awareness? And when does it become sort of an analytical, psychological thinking?
There might not be a sharp line between these different things. So because there's no sharp line, they all have their usefulness in different places, different times. Mindfulness is the minimum definition of mindfulness involves holding what's happening in the present moment in your mind. So staying with what's happening in the present. And if it's analytical, then it's not necessarily connected to what's happening in the present moment anymore. It's maybe reviewing what's happened in the past, the conditions in the past, the story in the past. Minimum definition of mindfulness is holding something in the present moment, in the mind. As you're holding what's in the present moment, sometimes you can use your reflective abilities to reflect and tease apart some of the different elements of what's going on in the present moment. Sometimes that's very helpful. Sometimes your analytical abilities get in the way because it gets you more removed from the experience. Sometimes it teases apart and gets you more intimate with it because you understand more elements of it. And so you have to discern when it's useful and when it's not. And hopefully you know very well the value at times of not analyzing, but just kind of being very, very, very present for what's actually going on, the fear, whatever, and feeling it in your body, sensing it, exploring the felt sense of it. And sometimes maybe you're aware of the motivations and the belief system behind it. But it's not analyzing the belief systems and the motivations, but it's more like noticing that's an element of the present moment also, teasing apart the different streams of the present moment itself. Is that helpful? Mm-hmm. Yes?
In trying to figure out how to attach to my own children as I'm raising them, it seems like there's a wish for them not to suffer, which is sort of consistent with Buddhism, which is we want to wish that suffering be reduced for all beings. But, you know, I sense that I'm unskillful in how attached I get about that, or in my imagining that I can know what's going to cause them suffering or not in the long run. And it actually, the same problem occurs in my job, where my job is taking care of people. So I might wish for them not to suffer too, but if I get too attached, I seem to be unskillful about that. So I struggle. You know, is the wish for somebody not to suffer a desire? How do I distinguish between desire, which makes me unskillful, and that wish, which we're supposed to have?
Desires by themselves are a natural part of life, a normal part of life, and we don't expect you not to have desires and wishes, but to start being mindful of when the desires and wishes entail suffering, which usually involves a contraction and a clinging that's connected to that desire, a compulsive nature of that desire, and then to feel that, to notice when it is that in your attachments, in your motivations, there seems to be some suffering. You're weighed down by it. It's a burden. You're getting a headache. You're tense around it. To really notice that and stop for that and then begin looking more carefully. What's this experience really? What's really going on in this experience? And be very mindful. Hold it in the mindfulness for a while. Just don't be in a hurry to analyze it or understand it. But just what it's like if you just hang out with it without acting on it. Just be with it for a long time. Just what happens. And sometimes it cracks open and you see other elements of it. Sometimes you might have to see in the cracks of it the roots of the desire. And maybe it's fear. And maybe what really you need to do is to resolve the fear that's within you. And when the fear gets resolved, then the fear won't be creating inappropriate attachments, inappropriate desires. The fear won't get mixed into the desire. And the desire will just be there as, in a healthy way. And so the investigation, the mindfulness investigation is really important. So stop and look. Yeah.
A lot of people, myself included, have been very affected by the economy and the changes in our lives around what we had and what we have. And I just met a man here on Thursday, and he was sort of saying the words that maybe I haven't been articulate enough to put into words, but he's been out of work for over a year. His wife just went through 8 weeks of therapy from breast cancer, and he said, "I'm so attached to what was. I don't know how to let go of the attachment." And his background was in Hinduism, so he's much more in tune with what you're saying, and I could really get what he was saying. So my question is, it seemed to me that what you said in a few words to this man was like three volumes. And like, where do you start with letting go?
Well, listening to you and listening to the tone of your voice and the way you're talking about it, that what comes to mind is you start with compassion for yourself. You start with some care and friendliness and love and compassion for yourself and your suffering and the difficulty of this that you might be having. And certainly, it's you know, we always start where we're at. So you know, you try to bring some mindfulness, some compassion, some presence to actually how you're experiencing. But you might think of the benefits you can get from a mindfulness practice in this kind of situation. Comes the most when you've built some momentum in the mindfulness practice, and there's some power in it. To suddenly to have a big crisis in your life and great suffering, and then come to some kind of spiritual practice hoping to have help. I think it can help in all circumstances, but there has to be some patience to let the momentum or the power of the practice to build. So the you develop a capacity to become calm and relaxed, to let go of some of your attention. Capacity to learn how to look at different things in a way that doesn't become reactive. So it's a slow training, and realizing that it's a slow training, sometimes it's discouraging because we want quick answers, but it's a slow training and retraining ourselves in how to hold and look at our lives. Sometimes we don't see our attachments that we're operating by until what we're attached to is taken away from us. And it can be very, very painful. And sometimes in the pain of it, the frustration, the despair, sometimes it's almost like there can be a kind of I don't know what the right word is here, but a kind of a self-absorption in the pain and the suffering that we're unwilling to make the effort to look over that and to what's really the attachment here, what was I really holding on to? Because we're so kind of being drained by the suffering itself. And that's why I think meditation practice, there's a lot of practices to be done. Meditation practice is one. I mean, going for long walks can be sometimes just as useful. Talking with a friend can be useful. But have some way of being present for your experience where you begin teasing apart the way in which you have you're reacting to it. So there's certainly suffering. And then based on that suffering, is there aversion to the suffering? Is there fear to the suffering? Is there holding on to the suffering? Is what's your relationship to the basic suffering of your situation? And to use some ability to be mindful, whether it's, as I said, in meditation or going for a walk or talking with a friend or whatever, to begin understanding not the solution to the problem you have, the suffering you have, but what's your relationship to it? Because sometimes it's a secondary, it's a relationship to our difficulty which sometimes becomes a hindrance in the problem, and it's often the key to understanding much better what's going on. So, for example, a relationship can be, this is too much, I can't deal with it. That's a relationship, that's an attitude we form towards our suffering, which gets in the way of really dealing with it. So, I'm just trying to give some brush strokes here of ways to approach it. If you want to start a daily meditation practice, which is very, very effective and powerful, then to include in that a sense of self-acceptance, self-compassion, and patience, so that the momentum of meditation practice over days and weeks and years begins really addressing and massaging and resolving these kinds of issues as necessary. Does that address this? So, life is not easy, but it's a lot easier if you're interested in looking at your desires, and if a lot easier even more if you're interested in learning how not to be caught by your desires. Desires can be a dime a dozen, and they can be very deep and tenacious and central to even our personality, and very much connected to these core, you know, almost biological instincts like parenting, or being a child of, or being in relationship to others, and they can be very, very deep, and it's phenomenally useful and to spend time really looking at the issue of desire and how it functions in your life, and not don't be satisfied with simple answers. But kind of look under the surface, kind of massage it, and how subtle can it be? You know, is it simply a desire for a certain thing, or is it a desire that this thing will make me kind of self-image of who I think I should be? And then more subtly, is that self-image, desire, that self-image, very simply the desire to be something, to be alive, to feel like you exist? And then conversely, to investigate, how deeply can you trust life? How deeply can you allow yourself to be deeply, deeply at peace within your heart, with how your life is? The more deeply you can be at peace, the less compelling the desires will be. When the peace becomes very, very deep, your desires will be like a mosquito trying to bite an elephant. So may you all become elephants.